This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This week I intended to explore the life of the founder of Peak Oil, and then talk with the world's greatest expert on coral and dying coral. But climate change is disruptive. This past week, even higher record heat struck the lands known for record heat. The heat wave in both India and Pakistan is deadly and hardly reported by the Western media. Temperatures rose above 128 degrees Fahrenheit, or 51 degrees centigrade, in the shade. It's the hottest ever recorded in India. That was in the city of Falodi, in the desert state of Rajasthan, northwest India. 52 degrees C was expected in Larkana, Pakistan. In this part of the world, as in Australia, heat already kills more people than any other natural hazard. The greatest mass death event in Europe this century was the 2003 heat wave. This is the second year of extreme heat in Southeast Asia. As we'll hear from two scientific guests, all this was predicted by recent studies. The same studies say it will get even hotter for longer periods as the decades progress. Already the heat is breeding despair, suicide, violence, refugees, poverty, and hunger for hundreds of millions of people. It can also become a hotbed for terrorism. 2 points from our coming guests. The poorest victims of this heat are the least responsible for global warming. The source is half a world away, where most of us live in fossil-powered luxury. But in a world connected by finance, trade, and airplanes, the blowback can travel back half a world away from the steaming countries of India and Pakistan. Second, we used to believe that some climate catastrophe will finally drive the world to sanity, to change. Now we know each stage of tragedy becomes the new routine, the new normal, and stops being reported. We'll talk with Dr. Michael Wehner, who co-authored the report on extreme weather for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He's got new research awaiting publication on the heat waves of India and Pakistan. I'll be sharing an email exchange with Indian scientist M. Rajivan. He's published research on the increasing frequency and severity of heat waves in India. Dr. Rajivan now heads the Climate and Meteorology Services for the Government of India. But first, I speak with one of Pakistan's leading intellectuals about the realities of punishing heat waves in a vacuum of public policy as his country struggles to survive our pollution. I'm Alex Smith. This week on Radio EcoShock, the news and science you need to hear about the hot new future.
Radio EcoShock.
The crushing heat in this year of 2016 is not the first to strike Pakistan and India. Just last year, thousands died, and Pakistan suffered a kind of heat paralysis. What happened then and now? Our guest is the Dean of the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. He's a professor of international relations concerning Earth and the environment. And Dr. Adil Najam was a vice chancellor at Lahore University of Management Sciences in Pakistan. Adil, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock. Let's talk about last year's heat emergency. 1,000 people died in the heat of Karachi in 2015. Please describe that heat event for us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for this conversation. Last year was a particularly bad year in terms of the impact of the heat. Now, Pakistan or South Asia is not a part of the world that is unfamiliar to heat, even to intense heat. This is the place where the highest recorded ever temperatures are routinely recorded. But one of the things that happened last year was that the intensity was more. The time period over which the heat wave persisted was more. This was true for South Asia in general, India and Pakistan in particular, and Karachi in Pakistan in particular. In Pakistan and Karachi's case, the perfect storm happened because this also came in the midst of the Muslim month of Ramadan, which is a month of fasting. And what that meant was that there were people who were fasting for religious reasons, who were trying to sort of push themselves harder, more than that, the infrastructure of support that is already missing in a poor country, especially for the poorest people, became even weaker. So all of these things combined to create this sort of massive wave and this number of, a very large number of people who died because of it. And it literally shook not just the large city of Karachi, but the country.
And just so we know, how many people live in Karachi?
Karachi is one of the largest cities in the world. You have certainly upwards of 10 million people living in this city. And I say that without precision because Pakistan has not had a census for a very long time. And the number of people who are kind of undocumented is even larger. So my own guess is we are talking about closer to 15 rather than 10 million people.
And is electricity for fans or air conditioning reliable in Karachi?
No, it is not. It is not reliable anywhere in Pakistan. But here is the thing. Anyone who can afford a air conditioner, which is very, very few people, and now I'm talking in single-digit percentages, can probably afford to run it because they'll also afford a generator of some sort. Anyone who can afford a fan, and that is not something that everyone would have, probably is still has some infrastructure to be able to survive and deal with this heat. The real issue is, and this is really the nub of climate change, that most people in a city like Karachi, but most people in this in the world, do not have the paraphernalia of dealing with these things that you and I might take for granted, right? We would take it for granted that, yes, you are poor, but that means you'll probably have a fan. Well, that's just not true for most people, not only in Karachi, but actually in the world.
And you have said half the deaths were preventable. What should national and state governments do to prepare for more heat events?
Well, I think all of the deaths are preventable. First of all, I am convinced that at least part of this, and we cannot say which part, is related to climate change. And if this is not, we would see more and more of that. And that means there's blood on your hands and mine. Right. So first, let's just start with that, that this is not just nature happening on its own. This is you and I and those of us particularly who are more affluent having outsourced our misery by our lack of action on climate change. But that may be a more deeper conversation. On an immediate level, I think that and many believe that these are preventable because this is not a country that is not used to heat. B, heat is something that you can deal with. It is a question of hydration. It's a question of not air conditioning as much as just getting water to people, making it easier for people to get a regular intake of water during the day. You know, things that we kind of take for granted and never talk about, a shade. Right now, you're talking about very poor people, mostly working outside in intense heat at a time when, because as I said, because of Ramzan, the infrastructure of dealing with that heat is low. Simply not having trees in a city, right? It's a very simple thing. But if you have ever walked anywhere in the sun, whether for pleasure or out of necessity, after a little while, if there is some place of shade where you can just sit and rest for a while, it makes a huge difference. And all of these things sound very, very small, but they are not, especially when they add up in a multi-million person metropolis. And that's why these are entirely preventable things. The tragedy is that we as a planet, and even Pakistan as a country, has the ability to deal with these things, and it is the negligence of our generation that these things keep happening. This time it was Karachi, but you also saw this in India. You see this with droughts in Africa and in Asia all the time. So there is a pattern to this. Here is my bottom line. People do not die because of heat. People die because of the inability to deal with that heat. And that means they die because of poverty, they die because of bad decisions, they die because of a lack of development.
That's so true. Well, it isn't just the heat. The 2010 floods in Pakistan were devastating. It must take years for the country to recover from such weather extremes, and I assume some farmers and families never do.
Some don't, but here is the well, sad thing about the flood, the 2010 floods, and we are now in 2016, never ended. What do I mean by that? We are now in the sixth consecutive year of floods, and now it doesn't even make the news. So there were multiple hundreds of people who died earlier this year in April in this year's flood. So every year since 2010, now the floods have kind of become this repetitive thing, and at least part of that is the melting of the glaciers up in the Himalayas, again, possibly with impact from climate change. And if you think about it, you know, I'm guessing your listeners are thinking, well, I didn't hear about them. That's because most people didn't hear about them. Even in Pakistani newspapers, it no longer makes news if 100 people die because of floods. And you kind of internalize this as if this is a new normal. Well, dying people should never be a normal. And it's not just the floods. We are also now in the fourth year of a drought in another part of Pakistan, in Thar, where children keep dying literally every day. And that also doesn't make news. And so this, to me, is the reality of a world with climate change. It is not simply the reality that there is more death and destruction and disaster. It is also the reality that you become immune to being moved by that death and destruction. It becomes a new normal, and we keep moving on as if, okay, this is how it was supposed to be. So if you look around the world at these climate-induced disasters, and you look at all of them together, you suddenly see, well, there's something happening. But we are also like that frog in boiling water, getting used to this as if, well, this is how it is. And that is a tragedy.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Adil Najam. We're talking about Pakistan in the new age of global heat. Let's talk about Pakistan's energy sources. I'm just learning about that ice loss in the northern mountains of Pakistan, which you just mentioned. I presume that the many hydroelectric dams have enough water to run?
The politics of energy in Pakistan is pretty intense, as it is in many, many developing countries. Pakistan, back in the 60s, was at the forefront of building large hydroelectric dams. They were the motors of Pakistan's economic growth at that time. There were some mistakes also made. But since then, this kind of this political logjam on building new hydroelectric power, largely because of differences between different parts of Pakistan and the feeling that these benefit one part and not another. It's not an entirely unreasonable feeling, but that sort of kind of brought to a standstill the ability of the country to use hydroelectric to its potential. And also, I think there was a certain fascination with large dams as opposed to small and medium and even micro dams that could have benefited. So at this point, Pakistan is sort of has less energy and has a major energy crisis. And unfortunately, instead of looking at renewable sources, a lot of the emphasis and passion is being spent towards trying to build coal. And that, in my view, is not the best of solutions, but it is the direction that the country seems to be heading towards.
Yes, I was surprised to find out Pakistan has undeveloped coal reserves.
Pakistan does have undeveloped coal reserves. It is not the best quality coal in terms of cost and environmental features. But people like myself have also been arguing that even if you leave aside the environmental aspect, and in many cases, I can argue legitimately that countries like Pakistan, which use very little energy to begin with, which have very low carbon footprints of their own, their responsibility is different from large countries like the US or Europe that, or China or India, that have very large carbon footprints. But even if for a moment you leave aside the carbon question, coal to me is a dying technology. It is pretty clear that the writing on the wall is that we are moving away from the age of coal. So if you think about it, the largest coal company in the US recently went bankrupt. Weeks after that, the largest coal supplier in the world, a Chinese company, announced that they're going to move to begin trying to be a supplier of renewable energy. So this is not the best time to move into coal, just from an economic and investment point of view. And I have been sort of arguing, you know, it's like buying a six-track right when the iPod is being introduced. It is a technology whose time is gone, and we now have better technologies, partly because a lot of renewables are now cost competitive. Both solar and wind in various parts of the world, including in that region, have started coming cost competitive. And therefore, I hope not just Pakistan, but many developing countries will leapfrog. If there is going to be an energy revolution in the world, I don't think it will come from mature economies in Europe and the U.S. as much as emerging economies leapfrogging, you know, just skipping the dirty technology and leapfrogging to a cleaner technology, kind of like they did with cell phones.
Given the suffering of Pakistan, from impossible floods to heat and drought, talk to us about the politics of climate change in Pakistan.
Unfortunately, there isn't much. Pakistan was mostly absent by its silence at Paris. But in my view, those who were speaking weren't making much sense either, but that's a separate issue. To the extent that there is climate change is an issue, unfortunately, Pakistan, like many other developing countries, has kind of wrapped itself in a shroud of victimhood. And it is not incorrect. It is correct. The victimhood is, we didn't create this problem. This is a problem that's been imposed on us by the excesses and the consumption of the developed world. Now, that happens to be true. But unfortunately, where I think it is wrong is that it leads to this thing, because we didn't cause it, we don't need to do anything about it. The reality of the science is that if you look at a world map of which countries and which areas are the most vulnerable, they are nearly all countries that have the least to do with creating the problem. So I can sulk in my victimhood, but that is not going to stop nature from throwing floods my way and heat my way and drought my way and glacial melt my way. And therefore, I think we are living now in what is the age of adaptation. And the front line of this, unfortunately, are the poorest countries, and within the poorest countries, the poorest communities. Now, that should again give a pause to you and me as, you know, the type of people who partly caused the mess. But it should also give us a moment to say, this is not simply about what we do with carbon. This is about how we do development. Because climate adaptation is a development issue. How do you deal with floods? Not by controlling energy. How do you deal with heat? How do you deal with drought? How do you deal with any of these disasters? You deal through better development. And I think that's where the solution is. And we need to start coming back to the place that climate essentially is a development challenge.
You know, at the gates of Europe, when we look at the makeup of refugees, some are from Pakistan. And I'm wondering whether it's just too hard to grow things there, too hot to stand living there, too hard to live there sometimes.
It could be, and I think there is a very legitimate concern about environmental refugees. And we've seen that happening certainly in Africa and possibly in South Asia, including in Pakistan. But here is, I mean, I don't want to throw a totally gloomy picture. There is a lot of good, there is not good news. There is a lot of potential that is positive also. So, for example, I led a study with some colleagues in Pakistan where we looked at what climate change impact on agriculture would be. This is mostly an agricultural country. And found that over 25 years, we found that for the two major crops, it could be up to 15% of yield. Now, that's a major thing if your economy is dependent on it. But here is the interesting thing. What we found was that with good adaptation practices, development, the yield could actually go up 60%.
60%?
60. 60.
Wow. Right?
And why is that? Because in Pakistan, as with many developing countries, there is a lot of room to grow into the better practices that they are not able to do because of lack of development. right? So either we treat climate change as a post-disaster reaction. We will wait for bad things to happen, and then we will, our humanity will arise, and we will send a little money so that we feel good about how we are helping the world. Or, as I've been arguing, we treat it as a development challenge, and before the bad things happen, we invest in development, and particularly what I was talking about, leapfrogging. So agriculture is one of those things. If you look at agriculture in developing countries, including Pakistan, there is a lot of room for good practices that would not only lessen the impact of climate change, but could actually allow countries to produce more. So I have always argued that the race here is between human knowledge and human wisdom. We have no dearth of knowledge on how to solve these problems. The challenge is that we have not demonstrated the wisdom or the will to deal with things that we are perfectly capable of dealing with.
Well, I think to do that, we'd have to escape something in our character that looks first at our own personal greed and very last at people on the other side of the world.
Exactly, exactly. And we have to realize that and this is where we may not yet be a fully evolved species. The assumption that what is good for me is only what happens in my immediate environment, you know, neighborhood, is just a patently false assumption. And that is why I get very concerned when anything first comes up, because it assumes immediately that everything else must be second. So to assume that someone on the other side of the world has no bearing on what happens to me, or should have no bearing, is not just morally wrong, it is intellectually bankrupt. And that we should have realized in realizing that the planet is interconnected. So just like Pakistan's floods or heat has to do with, may have as much to do with emissions, you know, half a world away, remember that what happens half a world away will impact us tomorrow. Maybe it impacts us, as you said, on those gates of Europe or tomorrow in the U.S., of people who leave their home and say, okay, if I can't live there, I'm coming where you are. But unless we start realizing that this is one planet, it's a fairly small planet, and we haven't done a good job with it, we are going to be in trouble.
What is the Pardee School of Global Studies?
The Pardee School of Global Studies is a school of international affairs. Boston University created the school 2 years ago by bringing together its various institutes and departments that work on international affairs. We have a global focus on global issues and on international issues. So at one level, it is like any other school of international affairs. We study international relations, we study war, we study peace, we study economic development, terrorism. But we do have a particular focus on the global aspects and this realization that for the first time in human history, there are a whole bunch of processes that are not just international between countries, but global in how they operate. Environment and climate is obviously one of them, but international finance is another. International migration is another. So international information is another. And so the school is trying to build a school of international and global affairs that responds to the 21st century challenges that we are faced with.
So Pakistan is the sixth most populous country in the world. We should be watching it. If we want to be Pakistan watchers, what should we look for?
I think we should look for what is happening to ordinary people in Pakistan, like you are right now with the heat wave. Unfortunately, we look at too much. We should also look at that, but we look at it too much from the perspective of international security and terrorism. And this, again, is one of those areas where issues get connected. I do not think these are unrelated issues. If you have large populations of people who are uncomfortable, whose economic opportunities are limited, who are made even more limited by climate change, they are going to make decisions that will not be rational. So what we should be looking for is what happens to ordinary people. And this is not just for Pakistan. I think that is true everywhere. And I'll go back to what I said earlier. The tragedy is not that we have massive challenges. The tragedy is that we actually have the ability to solve them, and we keep abdicating that responsibility. Floods are one, but let me give you an easier example, food. There is no reason in the world for at least a quarter century now that anyone should die hungry anywhere. Right? Just from a mathematical sort of statistical point of view, there is enough food to feed everyone. And yet we know that people die hungry all across the world, even in the most affluent societies. That is not a failure of agriculture. That's not a failure of food. That is a failure of our institutions globally. And you can apply that principle to a whole number of things, including on Pakistan. But, you know, it's Pakistan today, it's Afghanistan tomorrow, it's going to be Africa day after tomorrow. But we, unless we develop the capacity to think of ourselves as citizens of the globe, we are going to be in trouble. That doesn't mean we become less of a citizen of a Pakistan or a US or a Canada. But that does mean that we have to understand that we have the shared home and we have the ability to make it a better place.
You know, I'm concerned that we'll see continuous blows from climate disruption and it may lead to more failed states in different parts of the world. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about how it's going to go for Pakistan?
I suspect you are right, but for me, pessimism is not a choice. I don't know if I'm optimistic, but you have to keep trying. Right. If you become pessimistic and give up, then whatever little good that could happen will not happen. But I suspect that you are right, at least in part. I used to believe years ago, I spent too much of my life working on these issues. Years ago, I used to believe that maybe we will need some very great tragedy for the world to be shaken into action, that something really bad will happen and then we will act. Unfortunately, I and you have now lived to too many of those great tragedies, whether they are events like 9/11, whether they are floods like 2010, whether they are earthquakes in Nepal. We just keep getting tragedy after tragedy. And the unfortunate reality is that it has not shaken us up. In a way, it has routinized tragedies of a level that should not be routinized. You know, there's a rhythm to this. Something really bad happens. It gets plastered all over CNN. Twitter erupts in this great wave of empathy. And 2 days later, it's the next episode of the Kardashians or whatever, and we move on. And in some ways, our ability to show our empathy in 140 characters has made it easier for us to think, okay, my job is done. I wrote that tweet about how much I care about people dying this place or that. Now I can move on. And so part of me is a pessimist in that way. On the other hand, the possibility of our ability to do something keeps driving me to say we cannot give up.
Yes, a pessimist who won't give up. I think that's me as well. We've just heard from one of Pakistan's leading intellectuals. Dr. Adil Najam is an internationally recognized expert on international affairs. He's published widely and once hosted himself a public affairs program on Pakistan television. These days, he's at Boston University as the dean of the Pardee School of Global Studies. You can find links to all of this in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Adil Najam, thank you. It's been a pleasure to have you on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. In this next interview, be patient and you will be rewarded. Some listeners I know will be frustrated by the language of scientific caution at the start from our guest, Michael Wehner. But hang in. That caution makes his disturbing predictions all the more serious. When the atmosphere is loaded with extra warming gases, extreme weather appears all over the world. The latest outbreak is a giant combination of heat and drought over most of India and neighboring Pakistan. When the thermometer goes over 120 degrees Fahrenheit or 49 Celsius, it's deadly. Is this Indian heat emergency just natural variability? El Nino, or a preview of an unstable warming world. Here to help is Dr. Michael Wehner. He's a staff scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Dr. Wehner specializes in extreme weather events from rainfall to heat waves. He's published on the heat wave in Pakistan 2015, and he's watching this year's relentless heat in India as another case. Michael Wehner, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me.
What is your first take on this record-breaking heat wave that enveloped India in the spring of 2016?
Well, it's surprising because last year was also record-breaking in many ways in India. And the consequences on human health and well-being can be quite severe. And my sympathies go out to the people that are affected. And from a scientific point of view, these kinds of heat waves are very interesting. Of course, it's always been the case that there have been both heat waves and cold snaps that arise out of the natural variations in the climate system that we call weather. What we have learned recently is that we can actually determine in some probabilistic manner the effect that the human interference in the climate system has had on extreme weather events, if there is one. Sometimes there's not. But heat waves, in general, have some sort of detectable and attributable contribution. And, of course, this heat wave, just having occurred, it's a little difficult to say that with any authority. But it has been our experience that every major heat wave in the last several years that has been studied has shown some human influence. And by the human influence, I mean it is either more likely to have occurred and reached the temperatures that were actually measured, or conversely, if you consider an event of a fixed rarity, it might be it's a little bit hotter.
You know, Western media have done a lousy job covering this heat emergency in India, and it's embarrassing to ask, but why should my listeners in North America or Europe care about it?
Well, I think we should care, if for no other reason, the human tragedy. But I think it's not a wake-up call for me. I mean, maybe it should be a wake-up call for some, that global warming has an effect that is, like I said, detectable and attributable right now. So this is not something that's occurring in the distant future. You know, maybe a lot of what the people have read are about things that are going to happen 100 years from now. And in fact, you know, I've written a lot of that. But, you know, this is something that's here and now. And it's not just in India. The Texas heat wave in 2011 was shown to have the chances of reaching that level of severity were doubled by human changes to the composition of the atmosphere. Similarly, in Europe, in 2003 and again in 2012 and again last year, the human influence was shown to be even greater than that in the most recent ones. And this is true all over the world, that in general, heat waves have become a little bit more severe because of the global warming.
And these things can have geopolitical impacts. I'm thinking of the Russian heat wave in 2010, where the harvest was gone bad and they had to limit exports. And one of the world's biggest importers of wheat, Egypt, went into unrest, the Arab Spring. What do you think about the geopolitical impacts of these things?
Oh, I don't think that in a global economy, and particularly in a global agribusiness economy, there are long, what we would call in meteorology, teleconnections, you know, long distance effects from something happening in one part of the world. And the food economy is so interconnected that a crop failure in one part of the country, in one part of the world, can cause undue stress in other parts, and particularly in poor developing nations, where the fraction of income that anybody earns that is spent on food is much larger than in the fully developed nations. You know, that this connection between crop failures in one part of the world and political unrest in another is an interesting one. It's quite plausible. As a physical climate scientist, I realize how difficult it is to make a quantitative statement about such things.
Do you see a developing relationship between climate-driven weather extremes and the refugee crisis?
Well, this is something I also would believe is quite plausible, but again, a difficult thing to show causality on. But I think in many ways we've only seen the tip of this problem, this iceberg of a problem. The amount of climate change we've had since the pre-industrial age is about 0.85 degrees centigrade.
Now, in any plausible future scenario, 2 degrees of warming is almost virtually certain. You know, this is the target that the Paris meeting, the Conference of Parties, COP21 it was called, agreed to, and they wanted to further limit to 1.5 degrees. But these targets are so difficult to meet that there will have to be substantial reductions in the consumption of fossil fuels across the world, not just in the United States, although the United States would have to seriously move towards a carbon-free economy. I actually am very pessimistic that these targets would be met. Rather, you know, the most plausible ones that I believe are the so-called business-as-usual scenarios, which by 2100 lead to somewhere between 3.5 and 6 degrees warming. Now, these are planets that we have no experience with, and it is highly unlikely that there wouldn't be dramatic social upheavals. And so, you can be as pessimistic as you like on this, but the best case scenario is that there's twice as much warming as we have already experienced, and we are already seeing impacts on people's well-being.
And you published on these different pathways in the journal Climatic Change with Claudia Tibaldi. The title is Benefits of Mitigation for Future Heat Extremes under RCP 4.5 compared to RCP 8.5, and that's sort of a middle path and the worst case path. What did you find in that paper?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't call the difference between a worst-case path and a middle path. It was the difference between a rather dramatic reduction in carbon fuel consumption and the worst case that we considered. Now, you have to understand that the worst case we considered, and this was something that was developed for the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, fifth assessment report, which Claudia and I actually were both lead authors on. These scenarios of a future climate were constructed back around 2005. And so we know where we are relative to that worst-case scenario. And in fact, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is actually higher than what we thought was the worst-case scenario just 10 years ago. So that being said, what we found is that doing this rather dramatic reduction did have tangible benefits to reducing the future increased frequency of heat waves. And what I mean by that is that even in this dramatic reduction of carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere, the changes to the frequency and magnitude of heat waves is profound, but it's not as bad as if we don't do anything at all. And so the title was chosen to be positive, and we can credit Claudia for that. She's a very positive person. There is a very real benefit that would translate to social benefits to the rather large investments that would be required to change our consumption, our patterns of consumption of carbon dioxide. But I think it's important to remember that we're not off the hook.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Michael Wehner from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California. We're talking about killer heat waves and climate change. All right. Now, in 2015, there was a similar massive heat wave in Pakistan, and at least 1,000 people died in Karachi alone. You published a paper on this. I'm not familiar with this. What was the title of that paper?
Well, actually, that paper is in review right now. So we'll see how it goes. And off the top of my head, I don't remember the title. I think it's called The Deadly Heat Waves in Pakistan and India in 2015, or words to that effect. The interesting question when we started that work was, there were deadly heat waves in both India and Pakistan. They were separated by about 5 weeks. And so the first question was, how are these two heat waves related? And I honestly didn't know when we started. And what the answer was is that they're not actually related. The heat wave in India was due to a delay in the onset of the monsoon. What sometimes happens when the monsoon is delayed is that winds come from Pakistan and overland into central and eastern India, and they're hot and dry. And that was the cause of the 2015 Indian heat wave. In Pakistan, by the time the Pakistani heat wave had happened, which was late June, early July, in India the monsoon had fully developed. And so it rained, it was cooler. And in fact, especially in Karachi, which is the weather station that we use for this analysis, the winds had changed so that in Pakistan they were coming off the ocean, but it was still hot. And so it was hot and humid in Karachi. So in India, up until this year, actually, it was the hottest in some places that had ever been observed, but it was also dry. In Karachi, the temperatures were not the record temperatures, but the combination of heat and humidity were indeed records, as best as we can tell from the observations we have. In heat waves, the combination of high heat and high humidity is especially deadly.
And critics say some of those deaths in Pakistan in 2015 were preventable. What can governments or NGOs in developing countries do to help their populations survive extreme heat?
Well, this is a really, really good question, and one that is close to our present and future research. And this is what we found, especially in Pakistan, is that there wasn't enough warning for people to prepare. And then when the heat wave did really come into full swing, services, public health services, were overwhelmed. They were coming into hospitals at a rate greater than they could be treated or admitted, in fact. So what could NGOs do? They could help in two ways. One is in developments of early warning systems. These heat waves can be predicted several days at least in advance, if not a week or so. And so preparations could be made. But more in the long-term sense, infrastructural improvements are needed, especially in developing nations. But I should add, this could happen anywhere. In the Paris heat wave of 2003, many tens of thousands of people died because of that event. And part of that was because of social practices. And so, you know, what can be done in the United States and the developed nations? And this is interesting. Some cities, especially Philadelphia, have plans in place to check on the vulnerable. Now, who are the vulnerable in a heat wave? Well, oftentimes it's the very old, the very young, of course, too. But it's the very old and the poor. So systems that make sure that that these people are okay, you know, can really go a long ways to reducing the death toll.
So if the world continues to depend mainly on fossil fuels well past 2050, and that's what it looks like right now, how hot can it get?
Oh, this is the big question. Like I said, by the middle of the century, we should expect a minimum of at least another degree centigrade, which is about 2 degrees Fahrenheit, warming over now. And that's pretty much independent of what future scenario of greenhouse gas emissions we take. And that's one of the things about climate change, is that there's no immediate gratification to a change in the patterns of consumption of fossil fuels, because the climate system reacts relatively slowly. And so if we act now, we shouldn't expect too much of a change in the variety of things that could happen by the middle of the century. Where we would see that is like 2075 and afterwards. This is one of the things that makes climate change a difficult political issue, is that in order to realize any actual benefits, one has to take the actions long in advance of those benefits being realized.
Yes, the Save the Next Century movement isn't that strong.
You have to have an overriding concern for the welfare of your grandchildren and others, and other people's grandchildren as well, I should add.
What climate research interests you the most these days?
What I think is the most interesting area is the intersection of physical climate scientists like myself with social scientists. That is the most exciting thing that I'm involved in. And the reason it's exciting is because the conversation has only really begun to happen. My principal colleague is Federico Castillo at the University of California, Berkeley, and he's from Costa Rica. And when I teach in his class, I tell them that the big challenge we have is the language difference, and I'm not talking about the Spanish-English thing. And everybody laughs, because what I'm really referring to is the difference between talking to an economist and a climate scientist. We have different ways of looking at the world and different ways of doing our science, and bridging that gap is challenging but really interesting.
We'll have to leave it there. We've been speaking with climate and weather expert Dr. Michael Weiner. He is a senior staff scientist at the Computational Research Division at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California. He studies and publishes new science about the relationships between climate disruption and extreme weather events. And I'll put some links to all of that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Well, Michael, thank you so much for helping us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
To complete this Radio EcoShock feature on the heat emergencies in India and Pakistan, I wanted to get you a more official position directly from India, and I found exactly the right person. While working for the Indian Institute of Tropical Meteorology, Dr. M. Rajivan just published on May 19, 2016, a paper in the journal Nature. The title is spot on. It's On the Variability and Increasing Trends of Heat Waves Over India. Already, Dr. Rajivan has moved on to become the secretary to the government of India in the Ministry of Earth Sciences. As M. Rajivan was traveling, I was unable to reach him by telephone for this program. However, he sends us, by email, answers to my questions. This may be a bit strange, but I'm going to read you my short questions and his replies. First question, please tell us your role for the government of India. The reply, I am the head of the Ministry of Earth Sciences, which has the mandate of providing weather, climate, ocean, and seismological services in the country. Second question, why did you and your team undertake this research into heat waves? His reply, I am basically a researcher working on climate variability and monsoon prediction. Heat waves was one of my favorite topics of research, as it has social relevance. Last year, almost 2,500 people died due to heat waves. This year, another 500 people approximately, as per the news reports. My PhD student, Ms. Rohini, does this work with me. Then I asked, when did you begin this research and what are the main methods you used? This answer from Dr. Rajivan. It started almost 9 months back as part of her PhD thesis work. This work is mainly a data analysis using advanced statistical methods. The objective of the work was to identify whether there are trends in heat waves over India and what are the large-scale climate forcing for the variability of heat waves. I asked, did it surprise you when a major heat wave struck just a month after your paper was published? He writes, it was not a surprise. It was expected. In fact, this year we have started issuing a seasonal outlook on heat waves and informed people that this year we should expect above normal temperatures in the country with very high probability of severe heat waves in the country. That initiative was based on our results and understanding. We used a state-of-the-art climate model to generate probabilities of heat waves over India. I asked, how does this heat wave compare with those in the past? He replies, this year's heat wave is one of the worst. We had several days of extreme temperatures. Many temperature records were surpassed. At one station in West Rajasthan, Falodi, daytime temperatures touched 51 degrees centigrade. I asked him, what are the major findings of your paper? His reply, our findings are heat wave frequency, duration, and maximum length of heat wave events are increasing over the country, especially over central and northwest India. Total duration of heat waves has shown an increase of 1.3 days per decade and maximum duration 0.76 days per decade. Then we also analyzed major climate forcings that act on the variability of heat waves. We find that both the equatorial Pacific Ocean, El Niño events, and the equatorial Indian Ocean are responsible for the variability and trends of heat waves over India. We find that heat waves are not a regional phenomenon, but caused by planetary scale forcings, with the projections that major El Niño events increasing and the Indian Ocean warming anomalously, we can expect that frequency, duration, and maximum length of heat waves will show further increase in the future. I wonder, does India have a reliable way of reporting heat-related deaths? Dr. Rajivan says, we have some reports getting on heat-related deaths, but we do not have a decent way of recording deaths that occur due to weather anomalies, like heat waves. My next question, We have news reports that hundreds of farmers in India have committed suicide due to heat or crop failure. Is it true? He said, there are news reports, but I'm not sure about that. I cannot comment. I then asked, in India, are these kind of heat emergencies generally accompanied by drought? The reply, yes, to some extent. Last 2 years, droughts have caused soil moisture to deplete. Dry soil is one of the feedback processes to enhance the severity of heat waves. Therefore, droughts and heat waves could be linked. Next question. Does record-setting heat reduce the expectation of agricultural production in the year? His reply, heat waves do generally occur before the monsoon season starts. However, heat waves do not affect the ensuing monsoon season performance. I said, up to 600 million people in India do not have electricity. How do they cope when temperatures go above 120 degrees Fahrenheit? Dr. Rajivan simply said, good question. My next question, if the carbon dioxide levels continue to escalate and global mean temperatures rise above 2 degrees centigrade, what will that mean for India? This reply from Rajivan, this is really a concern. What the climate models project for the country are increasing heat waves and increasing frequency of heavy rainfall events. Therefore, we have to develop a strategy to meet the challenges and mitigation. Our government is seriously planning some measures towards this. My next question is about the role of governments. What can national and local governments do to prepare themselves and the population? He replies, there should be involvement from both local governments and national policies. There are some social issues also in our country. Many farmers and laborers work on outfields during daytime. Any type of warnings may not discourage them to go outfield for their work. They have to work and get their salary. In my last question, is there anything else you would like to leave with our listeners around the world? This reply from Dr. Rajivan, we have started prepared city-based heat wave action plans in which local governments and health departments work together with our ministry officials. That concludes our email interview. I appreciate Dr. Rajivan taking the time while he travels. With his key role advising the government of India, he will be very busy both with his current record-setting heat wave and his research into the prediction of monsoons, and that will eventually rescue India from the heat when the rains come. I'll put links to the full text of the new paper by M. Rajivan in my show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. The paper by M. Rajivan and his co-authors finds that for each decade studied, in India one more extra extreme event happened. Each decade, the heat wave lasts 2 days longer than the previous decade, and those extra days can be the most deadly for people, animals, and crops. Their study shows these great heat waves will only get more frequent and stronger as we move through this century. Greater tragedies and more suffering are already dealt in the carbon card game. We know from other science that's not just for India. This is the future for Paris, for Moscow, for the American South, for the Arctic, for Brazil, Africa, everywhere. As we've heard, this unbearable heat is accompanied by drought. Tens of thousands of farmers in India have fled their burned-out fields to live in city shanty towns. Reuters reports hundreds of farmers there have killed themselves instead. With water shortages come the usual killer diseases. Nobody knows how many have died from this heat emergency in India or Pakistan. The grave diggers of Karachi are taking no chances. They have prepared an extra-large trench for mass burials. But who are the grave diggers of Karachi? We are. Here's the big picture from the science by our guest Michael Wehner and his co-author Claudia Tibaldi. I'll quote from a press release about their study. Sweltering heat waves that typically strike once every 20 years could become yearly events across 60% of the Earth's land surface by 2075 if human-produced greenhouse gas emissions continue unchecked. End quote. This press release from the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research continues, if emissions remain unabated, a heat wave with a 1 in 20 chance of occurring in 2050 would be at least 3 degrees Celsius, that's 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter for 60% of the world's land areas. For 10% of the land areas, a 20-year heat wave in 2050 would be at least 5 degrees C or 9 degrees Fahrenheit hotter. We're talking about a different planet, people, than the one you grew up on. So why don't those Indian or Pakistani people just stay home, turn on the fan, or go down in the cooler basement? Many don't have a home, much less a basement. Millions, likely hundreds of millions, cannot afford a fan or find the electricity to run one. And if you don't go to work in the hot, hot day of the fields, your family doesn't get any food either. Those who can leave will leave. They will come to where it's cooler, to places where there are fans and electricity. They will come however they can. Others, as Adil Najam says, will make irrational choices and decide to kill the affluent people they perceive to be killing them. It's all connected now, in nature and in the human economy. What happens on the other side of the world matters. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for joining us this week on Radio EcoShock. As we leave, I'd like to play my small tribute to another strong voice who left us last week. Michael Marriott headed the Nuclear Information and Research Service in Washington, D.C. since 1985. He helped turn the tide away from the madness of nuclear power in the United States. Here you go, Michael. Here's my song for you.
Still committed
to the very last
to the very
day.
Last day.
To the truth.
Michael Marriott.
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 In the 1990s alone, a number of nuclear plants have closed. Four in New England, for example, Yankee Row, Millstone 1, Maine Yankee, Connecticut Yankee. We've had two reactors close in Illinois, the Zion reactors. We've had Trojan close in Oregon. Rancho Seco in California closed in 1989. San Onofre in California closed in the 90s. In 1974, then-President Richard Nixon said there would be 1,000 nuclear reactors operational in the United States by the year 2000. Today, we will have less than 100.